in the blood of those who are sacrificed to them. This lifeblood can give them shape and form, a terrifying form that only the priests may behold without losing their minds.
And were you one of them?
No, but I was able to look on them and keep my wits.
Maybe that's why your mind has holes in it now.
Firstly, my mind does not have holes in it. My memory does. And secondly, I've had enough of telling horror stories now.
Ironheart hugged his knees and wiggled his toes.
How many unholy ones are there? What do they do to be worshipped like that? Do they help in warfare?
He looked at Tungdil, who was already asleep.
Oi, scholar! Give me a chance to learn something.
Should he dare to throw another piece of wood?
How do you know Tiragon so well? I mean, what did the two of you get up to over there? And why on earth did you take the name of your dead?
That's enough! The eye shot open, and Ironheart was greeted with a stare that delivered physical pain. The brown iris was penetrating as an arrow. Then it disappeared to be replaced by a greenish pulsating light, which transmuted into a pale blue. One last flicker, and the brown returned.
I want to sleep, Ironheart. There are many orbits ahead of us on our ride to the Blue Mountains, and I will tell you more each time we make camp for the night. But not now.
He spoke with emphasis, regal and sharp, annihilating any objection. Then he shut his eye and arranged himself in a more comfortable position.
Said Ironheart, kicking up the dust. That was the false Tungdil again.
Without thinking, he picked up a branch and started whittling away at the end. His movements gradually became slower. His gaze rested on the sleeping dwarf.
Then I'll sing a song to stave off boredom, he decided,
and began a tune that Bavrigor had taught him. He tapped out the rhythm on his leg armor. But Tungdil did not react, annoyingly. At that moment, Rodario came tearing through the bushes, his clothes awry, as if he had dressed in a hurry.
The Queen has gone!
He called out in agitation.
Disappeared off the face of the earth? Or has she run away because you were importunate?
Ironheart grinned.
Thought you were having a bathe. Not likely.
Rodario came up to him.
She was scared, and ran away.
Scared of your one-eyed trouser snake, I suppose.
Listen to me, he grabbed the dwarf by his broad shoulders. She's run off into the undergrowth.
You still haven't said what scared her, but never mind.
He called Baskalin to ask which way the queen had gone, but the Zadar's leader did not know.
My men were following her. We were watching the surrounding area. We weren't watching her and the actor,
he explained to Ironheart.
You were spying on us,
fumed Rodario.
No, or this would never have happened, muttered Boindil bad-temperedly, turning to Tungdil. Scholar, wake up. We've got to find the Maegar and catch her. The nervous little filly has been shocked by a trouser snake and has run off into the undergrowth somewhere.
A very sleepy Tungdil opened his eye reluctantly. The glance he shot at Rodario promised him a long, unpleasant death. They raced through the thickets downstream in a long line. They could not take the ponies with them, so the Zadar and dwarves had to go on foot to pick up the Queen's tracks. The Invisibles easily found her trail, but the Maegar had a head start. Their short legs put them at a disadvantage, but they could not let Rodario or Millennia run off ahead under their own steam, for neither had the skills needed to follow the faint marks left by the Maegar's feet. The part of the forest they were in now was not welcoming. There must have been a forest fire there about a quarter of a cycle ago, one that had left ruined tree trunks behind. Scorched and shriveled and dead, these hulks stood eerily on the black, empty ground. Men and dwarves ran through the ash, their feet disturbing it so that it rose in clouds to clog mouths and noses and make eyes smart. Half-burned branches crumbled under their feet, and their boots and clothing turned grey. Then they came to the ruins of an old building. The fire must have taken hold of a little forest hamlet. Eyeheart could see skeletons.
Why did the people not flee from the flames? Perhaps they were not able to run.
The thought of magic occurred to him at once.
Over there, called Tungdil, pointing to the right. I can see someone running.
Eyeheart could not see a thing.
I think. Yes, agreed Baskelin. It's a human.
Millennia nodded to Rodario to put on a spurt of speed.
We'll catch up with her,
the latter told the dwarves as he followed Millennia. Strange emotions were swirling within him. On the one hand, he was reproaching himself, but on the other, he was not sure why. Koira had taken flight because of his cry of horror, which she had misunderstood. But there was no time now to put things right. First of all, they would have to catch up with her. Millennia had shot ahead, but he would not be shaken off. The group of dwarves were now some way behind. The forest was changing again. The trunks now seemed to have been bent and twisted by the force of the fire, taking out the strangest of shapes. It was already growing darker here, so that the trees appeared terrifying, and the deadly hush that surrounded them made Rodario deeply uneasy. He was glad he had his sword at his side, and Millennia, who was definitely a better warrior than he was.
Koira, stop!
He called out after her as she ran through the trees. She was extremely agile.
We are really worried about you.
But the fugitive was not listening.
Come on, call yourself a hero? Get a move on, said Millennia, increasing her speed. I don't like it. Everything here is dead. This forest is scary.
He silently agreed with her. There was nothing here, however, that could harm them. The fire was long gone, having consumed everything living and turned it all to ash. The queen had changed course and was heading off to the right. Between the scorched tree trunks they spied the outline of a fortified house, a defended barn or similar. Judging from the marks left by the flames, it seemed the fire must have broken out in this building and then spread to the forest. The queen ran through the small gate and disappeared inside the ruin.
What's she doing? Panted Rodario. Is she trying to hide from us? That's just stupid. Childish and stupid.
Millennia left the forest and headed for the entrance.
Queen Koira, come out of there before you fall down some hole or get buried by falling masonry.
She went into the courtyard with Rodario at her heels. They waited, listening out and watching the broken window panes, which stared back at them like empty eye sockets.
Koira,
Rodario called, very worried now.
You misunderstood me back there at the pool. If you come out, I can explain. So it is your fault.
Millennia seized on this possibility.
I bet you said the wrong thing.
Rodario had decided not to speak about the ghastly discovery he had made. He wanted to speak to Koira first.
Something like that.
When he saw a face by one of the downstairs windows, he raced off.
Koira, wait for me!
He grabbed hold of the crumbling wooden supports and peered into the dark room. He was staring at a pair of light-colored eyes that were watching him fearfully. They were the eyes of a man.
Chapter 22. Girdlegard, former queendom of Ran Riba Stir, Northwest. Spring, 6,492nd solar cycle.
Rodario sprang back and turned to Millennia.
It's a man in there. Are you sure?
He leaned further in over the wooden frame and surveyed the stranger's face.
Absolutely sure. The stubble is a strong clue.
Indeed, then it won't be the queen.
Unless she has metamorphosed.
Millennia came over to the window to see for herself. She guessed the man to be in his late 30s. Once upon a time, the garb he clutched about his body must have been a luxurious robe the color of malachite. Now it was a shabby, tattered rag. Thorns had torn holes, and the forest floor had stained it. The man was wearing a greasy leather cap on his dark blonde hair.
"What is your name?"
she demanded. The man cringed and crawled further back inside the room. As he did so, ash and charcoal crunched under his hands and feet. Rodario caught sight of four costly rings on his fingers.
"He's no beggar, that's for sure."
"Perhaps he managed to escape the fire but lost his mind." Millennia kicked the wall sharply.
"Where is the queen?"
At the gate, Tungdil was arriving with the other dwarves. She told him quickly what they had found. Rodario climbed in through the window and slowly went up to the man.
"Don't be afraid. We won't hurt you."
"Says who?" came Ironheart's voice from the open window. "If he's a villain, then we will."
"But you aren't a villain, are you?"
Rodario crouched down by the man.
"You're some rich man who has lost his way. Perhaps you were robbed. Or have magic plants been your downfall? Have you caught sight of a woman with long dark hair, in a dark blue dress?"
Behind him, there came a crash and metallic clang, and grey dust rose up, settling on the sweaty face of this unknown figure. It was Tungdil, who had just jumped in at the window. The man whimpered and cowered, his arms round his head for protection. Tungdil grasped the man's right hand and pulled it hard, then brushed the dirt off the man's sleeve to reveal an embroidered symbol. He frowned, and his face grew dark.
"You are one of Nudine's followers,"
he challenged the man, grabbing him by the throat.
"You have the effrontery to copy his style of dress and even his rings."
Rodario stood up and placed a hand on his sword hilt.
"One of Lotionen's Famuli."
"Ha!" said Ironheart triumphantly. "What a good thing I didn't agree we wouldn't harm him."
"He looks like one."
Tungdil dragged the man over to the window and hurled him out into the courtyard.
"We'll find out what he was doing here, and how much magic he still has."
He instructed the Zadar to increase their vigilance, then climbed back out.
"Did he tell you his name?"
"No."
Rodario followed the two of them outside and stood by Millennia.
"I wanted to try the gentle approach first. He seemed very distressed, so I thought rough and loud treatment wouldn't prove helpful."
Tungdil drew Bloodthirster, placing the weapon's tip at the man's throat.
"Talk!"
"Frannic," he stammered. "My name is Frannic."
Ironheart grinned. Occasionally there was something to be said for the dwarf technique of interrogation.
"What brought you here? Why are you dressed like Nudine?"
Tungdil gave him a kick that had him over on his back.
"I don't have time to waste. We're looking for a woman."
"I saw her,"
Frannic said quickly, raising his hands.
"Please, don't. I saw her. I know which way she went."
Ironheart had his crow's beak ready.
"He could have been sent by Lotionen to lead us into a trap."
"But how would he know we were coming?"
Rodario studied Frannic.
"Shouldn't we hear his story first?"
"For me, the queen is more important," interjected Millennia.
"And the same should go for all of us, surely."
She addressed the putative Famulus.
"Tell us, where did she go?"
He slowly lifted his arm and pointed east.
"To the Votons. She'll be dead by now."
"Who are the Votons?"
Tungdil did not remove Bloodthirster from the man's throat.
"Hideous beings. Chimera, the result of Vote's experiments. He was one of Lotionen's Famuli,"
he explained, breathless with fear.
"They used to be humans, but he equipped them with the limbs of animals. They broke out of his laboratories and fled here."
Tungdil gave orders to Baskelin in a language they did not understand, and the Zadar raced off. Then he turned to Rodario.
"You stay and keep an eye on our friend here. He'll have a few more questions to answer when we get back with the queen."
Ironheart shook his head doubtfully.
"We're setting an actor to guard a Famulus?"
"If he could still do magic, he probably wouldn't look like a dog that's been half beaten to death."
The one-eyed dwarf indicated the quiescent runes on his armor as evidence there was no magic activity present.
Slynn can keep you company. The rest of you, come with me.
He charged after the invisibles, leaving the three of them alone in the courtyard. Slynn closed the gate and lit a fire. Rodario handed Franek something to drink and brought over a few old timbers to sit on. The fourthling laid his loaded crossbow on his knee. He scanned their surroundings carefully, on watch.
Right then, Franek. How about you help us to while away the time by telling us what made you want to carry on Nudine's work?
Rodario sliced some bread and ham. He gave some to Slynn, and the rest he passed to the Famulus.
So you were apprenticed to Lot Ionan?
Franek looked at the actor.
A group of dwarves in black armor, an actor and a blonde woman, all looking for a queen. That all seems very odd.
Don't try to turn things around, my friend. You are going to report first, said Rodario,
or I take your food away.
I'll shoot it out of his mouth for him,
Slynn offered, lifting the bow.
The food and bolt will fly out together through the back of his neck.
Franek stretched out his hands to the warmth of the flames. Out of the sun it quickly grew cool. Spring had not yet transformed the winter nights.
All right, I'll tell you.
He took a deep breath.
I'll know if you're spinning a yarn,
the fourthling warned him before he began.
Then my finger will jerk on the crossbow, and you know what will happen next.
Rodario looked at him, tight-lipped. Franek began his story.
Ingratitude. That's all I ever got from the Magus. A girlfriend and I fetched him out of the cellar in Purista when he was imprisoned there as a statue. We escaped from the guards, but the statue was stolen by other Famuli. I nearly died. When I had recovered, I tried to enter Lot Ionan's service. I wanted to become a Magus, and that's how I was granted my longevity.
He asked for and was given more water.
I was always there when he needed me. Together we conquered the Blue Mountains and annihilated the dwarves.
Charming. Tell us something different,
growls Slynn, waving the crossbow.
My finger gets itchy when I hear stuff like that.
As I was saying, we closed the gate to the south, and I supported him when he was nearly killed by the leader of the Black Eyes. And how did he repay me?
He indicated his apparel.
Threw me out, he did.
Not without reason, I expect.
Rodario listened carefully, trying to see if Franek was lying. He hadn't noticed anything yet.
For a stupid reason.
What was it?
Slynn's fingers caressed the crossbow.
I want to know.
Franek sighed.
The magic source. No one is allowed near it to refresh their powers without his permission.
But you went there anyway.
What choice did I have? He was asleep and I had to...
He stopped.
Anyway, one of the other Famuli woke Lot Ionan and told on me. So he drove me out of the caves and allowed all the other Famuli to hunt me down and try to kill me. Traitors had to be punished, he said.
He's right there, muttered Slynn with a grin.
If it hadn't been for me, he'd still have been lying in a cellar in Purista, the old fool.
Franek did not follow up Slynn's remark.
I escaped through the deserts of Sangpur. Finally, there was only one of them on my tail, and I threw him off the scent near where the Votons hang out.
He looked at Rodario.
I thought you were him. That's why I ran away.
How many pupils does the Magus still have?
4. Two of them are not much use, but he hasn't noticed that yet. Vot and Bumina are his best ones. Apart from me, of course,
Franek shrugged.
There's really nothing else to tell.
Slynn looked at Rodario.
Didn't he just say he'd shaken off his pursuer near the Votons?
The actor had been watching Franek's features so closely for signs of dissembling that he had missed this detail.
By Palandiel. We must warn the others.
Slynn looked doubtful.
How would you find them in the dark?
My sight is sharper than yours, but I can't run so fast.
Without warning, he shot Frannick in the thigh. The man collapsed with an agonized cry.
Serves you right, you treacherous lungen. For every one of our lot that gets hurt, there'll be another crossbow bolt for you. 3, if anyone's killed. Luckily, you're long enough to have room for several shots.
He reloaded.
Stop it, Slynn!
Rodario called out. He could understand his comrade's anger. Frannick had purposely kept them in the dark about the danger. Rodario helped the victim to extract the bolt from his flesh and bandaged the injury with a strip of material they cut off his robe.
I forgot about Droman,
whimpered the Famulus, clutching his leg. The bandage was already soaked through with blood.
I swear by Samusin that I didn't send your friends off to danger on purpose.
Well, said Slynn, pain's good for making you remember. He did not regret having shot the man. Rodario got up and went to the gate, opening it a crack. He looked at the crippled, charred trees. There were particularly tall ones by the barn, stretching up into the night sky, and they cast long shadows. He could neither see nor hear anything of the Ido girl or the dwarves.
How strong is Droman?
He called back into the yard.
His sorcery, you mean?
Frannick groaned, tearing off a second bandage from his clothing to stop the bleeding.
He's not as good as me if my magic is working properly, but my magic powers are exhausted. I can't even heal myself.
He looked at Slynn.
So I'd be as vulnerable as you, or this mole fellow here.
Rodario saw a shadow in the woods. It was bent double and making its way over to the barn, dodging from tree to tree. Not nice, he murmured, both in reply to Frannick's words and in response to the sight. The worrying thing was that the longer he stared, the more shadows he thought he could see. The silhouettes did not look human. He quickly locked the gate and returned to the fire, throwing more logs on.
Votons, he explained. I hope they're afraid of fire. Now would be a good time to show off your skills, Slynn.
Charming.
The dwarf took his bolts and stood up.
As long as there are no more than 50 of them, we should be all right. After that, I run out of ammunition.
Rodario did not answer. He thought there might be more. They were running through the twilight, with 2 Zadar at the front. The size of more footprints they had found indicated they were probably made by Koira. But they had also found a number of different tracks that were not so easy to identify. Without what they had heard from the Famulus about the Votons, they would probably have thought them made by a herd of cattle. But the creatures responsible for these seemed to have both human and animal feet. Baskalin identified cattle prints alongside the human first. But there were also the pad marks of bears and other wild animals.
I know why I don't like magic, said Ironheart grimly. Unnatural animals. They may have legs like cows, but you won't be able to cut them up and roast them on a spit to eat.
Isn't your wife a Maegar? And 2 of your children too?
Tungdil jumped over a fallen tree with ease, as if the armor didn't represent any additional weight. Ironheart took a little longer to get over the obstacle.
That's a different sort of magic,
he corrected.
Dwarf magic. It's never hurt me, not in 200 cycles. Never harm me or anyone else.
But if Goda had remained with Lot Ionan, who do you think we would have been campaigning against now?
Tungdil's voice sounded like a chief negotiator picking holes in the argument of the other side.
And perhaps it would have been you wearing my sort of armor. Never, Boindil blurted out. I mean, Goda would never have allied herself to evil. Fair enough. I was only putting an idea out there.
Tungdil swung to the left at a signal from the Zadar. The trees were thinning out, and they found the queen face down on the scorched earth.
Rakus, don't let her be dead,
Ironheart prayed, leaping forward and waving his crow's beak threateningly.
Ho, you mad Magus-inspired creatures, stay in your hiding places.
He lowered his head.
Or better still, come out and let me rearrange your limbs for you.
Tungdil knelt down next to the girl and turned her over. The Zadar surrounded them, keeping a sharp lookout over the surrounding area.
She's still breathing, he said to Ihart. I can't see any injuries. Perhaps she's just overcome with exhaustion.
Koira's eyelids flickered.
Take care, she whispered weakly. They have set a trap for you. A famulus.
A bright stream of magic shot out from behind the trees and struck one of the Zadar full in the face. His head vaporized and his torso tumbled convulsing to the ground, as if the body was trying to carry out avoidance tactics. Blood came spurting out of the stump, splashing everyone.
Get under cover!
Tungdil leapt forward, trying to locate the Famulus in the shadows. Ihart certainly was not going to be seeking shelter.
He's mine!
He ran 4 paces at Tungdil's side to face the perfidious attacker.
I'll beat you to a pulp, Frenic, he vowed,
utterly convinced the Famulus they had found must have overpowered the actor and fourthling and followed them to attack from behind.
You won't get away with this,
he shouted angrily. He was all the more bemused then to see a man appear before him in a pale grey hooded tunic and knee-high boots, and with a broadsword hanging from his weapons belt. He was wearing light brown gloves and had his arms raised. Presumably, this unknown figure was in the middle of casting another spell.
How many more of you are there in this accursed forest?
Yelled Ihart, launching an attack.
You're worse than mushrooms!
Then he realized he had misjudged the distance between himself and his foe. Before he could reach his adversary, he saw the left hand release 3 lilac-colored rays that fused into one, heading his way. Just before the ray touched him, a black wall sprang up to protect him, and then Ihart saw a number of runes glowing brightly in front of his face as a wave of heat passed over him. The dazzling light affected his eyes. No matter which way he turned his head, he could only register the after-images of those symbols, making it well-nigh impossible to attack the Famulus.
Scholar!
He called, listening for a response. There was a hissing sound, and again it grew, as bright as day.
Blast! Things were just getting better, Ihart complained.
He could hear the clank of metal on metal. Then there was a roar, and brightness and dark alternated swiftly, until there was a loud shout and a body fell onto the ash-strewn forest floor.
Tungdil!
At least Ihart was now able to recognize outlines. The squat black shape in front of him must be his friend. A human lay dead on the ground.
Thanks, Peter Vrakus, he said,
relieved and disappointed at one and the same time. He had badly wanted to be the one to fell the enemy.
This hocus-pocus is getting on my nerves. How did he get here?
He rubbed his eyes until he could see clearly again. Tungdil had sliced the magician right through, and then finished him off with stabs to the heart.
These are Lotionan's personal signature runes on his tunic, he mused.
Was it him and Frenic together, do you think, setting up that ambush? Or is he here by coincidence?
Ihart went over to join Tungdil. The two of them looked at the young man's corpse. Tungdil rammed Bloodthirster into the ground and searched the body and the rucksack. Apart from a bag of coins, he found 2 keys, some provisions, and maps of Sangpur and Ran Ribastur.
Not very much there. No, not very much.
Ihart leaned on his weapon.
Let's get back to the barn. Frenic can tell us who this fellow is.
Tungdil ordered 2 of the Zadar to carry the corpse. Melenia supported the half-conscious Koira. She was too weak to be able to speak much, but hinted that the Famulus had ambushed her and struck her down with a spell.
Oh, my blessed forge, Ihart murmured, stroking his beard. If she can't stand up to a poxy Famulus, how is she ever supposed to cope against Lotionan?
Victoriously,
was Balindar's reply.
I don't doubt her abilities. If you get an arrow in the back, what earthly use are your crow's beak and all your courage?
Ironheart had to admit the young dwarf was right, but he was not happy about it, and for some time went on searching for what would have been the perfect riposte.
Slynn had climbed up to the hayloft and opened the loading hatch above the gate. Lying flat on his stomach, he held the crossbow in front of him, his bolts stacked at one side. As he watched the scorched forest, he made out several figures approaching the ruined building. His dwarf eyes enabled him to detect the enemies in the twilight. Whatever the Fomulis Vought had done in his experiments, merging humans and animals, these creatures were horrific. Slynn saw a massive man's body, which bore an ox head. Where flesh met fur, a stream of pus was oozing out. A pair of arms had been exchanged for the paws of a bear. On another monster, he saw the hind legs of a horse, and yet others had tentacles instead of arms. Some of the experiments were even worse. Vought had given human limbs and heads to animals. In three cases, the chimerae had extra heads. The clothes of these former human beings hung in shreds. Some of the monsters were completely naked, while others wore blood-soaked rags. Slynn was more deeply disturbed by the sight of these abused and mutilated bodies than he would have been by a host of Teon's own monsters. Knowing that these had once been ordinary humans, not evil beasts, affected him greatly. Even as he aimed at the heart of the first approaching enemy, his conscience told him he should spare the creatures and try to help cure them. "Perhaps Koira can do something," was his first thought. But it was no good. She would have to conserve her magic powers in order to prevail against Lot Ionan. "It's no use putting things off."
Slynn doubted the horde of Chimerae would be persuaded to stop on the strength of a vague promise or two.
He had no choice.
"Vracus, you know this is the only way."
He fired the bolt. The shot pierced the naked breast of the bull-headed man, who stumbled and measured his length on the ash-covered floor. Clouds of dust rose up. Slynn reloaded.
The Chimerae were a good 300 paces away.
"It's impossible to shoot all of them. I haven't got the ammunition or the time."
He yelled down to the others to hide, and to keep their weapons at the ready.
"I shan't be able to hold them all off."
His next victim was a woman with the legs of a horse. She was quicker on her feet than the others. She fell to the ground with a scream, losing her sword.
Two wolf-based chimerae were coming through the trees.
They had human heads, but Vought had grafted on animal snouts, which gave them a grotesque appearance. Slynn managed to shoot one of them, but the second had already reached the gate.
"Watch out! There's one at the gate!"
he warned Rodario and Franek, reaching for his bugle. He desperately needed the support of the Zadar, otherwise his mission to find fame and adventure in the burned-out forests of Ran River Stir would be meeting an untimely end.
He let out a blast on the bugle, and the Chimerae reacted with a shock to the sudden booming noise.
Then he concentrated on doing away with the biggest and most dangerous-looking of the monsters. In some cases, he shot them through the heart, but they only seemed to die after he had sent several bolts through their heads. Magic had made them almost invulnerable. Or perhaps their hearts are not in the normal place.
The selection he made led to some of the smaller Chimerae getting through to the gate.
They set up a cacophony of roars, shrieks, and barks, sending shivers up the dwarf's spine. Suddenly there was a crash, and the creature's noise was now coming from the inner courtyard.
"Where else am I expected to be, all at the same time?"
Slynn turned round and aimed at the first thing he saw. Rodario and Franek had not sought hiding places. Instead, they had lit an enormous fire in the middle of the yard and armed themselves with burning planks.
"Charming. The Longans are keen to do the hero thing,"
Slynn mumbled into his beard, shooting one of the wolf figures, which had been about to spring at the actor. In contrast to normal animals, these beasts did not seem worried by the heat and flames. Something whipped through the air behind him, and there was a tight feeling round his ankle as a tentacle trapped his leg. He turned, reloading as he did so.
A Chimera man with tentacle arms had pulled himself up the wall and was halfway through the hatch.
One arm was wrapped around Slynn's leg, and with the other he was hanging from a beam.
"Come over here to me, dwarf," he growled.
The tentacles tightened.
"I'd rather send you something over."
Slynn fired, but because his leg was being tugged from under him, he lost his footing, and the bolt went astray, piercing not the creature's heart, but its shoulder.
The Chimera man screamed and pulled Slynn over, while climbing further up through the hatch.
The second tentacle grabbed a beam and broke a piece off to use as a club. The makeshift weapon thundered down, but the dwarf had seen it coming and was able to dodge. Holding the crossbow steady with both hands, he swung it like a pickaxe against the massive tentacle, but it was not enough to sever it.
Now he was at the feet of the Chimera man.
The enemy pressed his boot into Slynn's face. The tentacle round the leg slackened, and then was placed round his throat. The dwarf employed the second mechanism on his crossbow, making a hidden dagger shoot out. He sliced through the tentacle, and his adversary hopped backwards.
"I don't need the bolts,"
Slynn shouted as he followed through, stabbing again and again. But his adversary had been paying attention. He swerved, and the stump of his tentacle swept the crossbow aside. The second long snake-like arm was going for Slynn's head. Slynn ducked and pulled a hatchet out of his belt. He limped over to the right and put a support pillar between himself and the monster. The leg that had been mangled felt swollen. He was struggling to avoid further attacks. Two more hybrids swung up through the trap door. They also had tentacles instead of arms. Vought had given the woman the head of a boar. The man had the skull of a bear on his shoulders. The three of them united to hunt Slynn down, sending out their whip-like arms time and again to block off any escape. Slynn was at his wit's end.
"You asked for it,"
he told the Chimera, brandishing his hatchet.
"I'll do for you all!"
With a loud war cry, he launched himself at the creatures. A second tentacle dropped, severed, to the floor, where it executed a macabre, spiraling dance. But then four tentacles surged forward and swarmed round to encompass his upper body, legs, and throat. Slynn felt himself lifted up. Then the pressure became pain, and his head swam. He wanted to call out, but the bonds round his throat were too tight, and he failed to utter a single sound. Rodario dodged the attacking bear claws and smashed the burning plank against the Shimmerer's head. Red and yellow sparks flew up, and the head snapped round. The neck broke with an audible crack, and the Shimmerer fell dead.
"Another over by you, Frenic,"
he warned the Famulus. The man avoided the fangs from the wolf's head and hit back with both the planks he was holding, crushing bone between two pieces of wood. Rodario glanced over at the open gate where the monsters were flooding in. Slynn had already sounded a bugle call for assistance, but if Tungdil and the Zadar did not arrive soon, help would be too late arriving.
"Why doesn't he shoot?"
Suddenly the dwarf appeared in the loft opening, took aim, and dispatched a wolf Chimera with a single shot. Then he disappeared.
"What's Beardy doing up there?"
Frenic was thrashing about with the planks, but the attackers kept returning for more. They had smelled blood and were not going to give up or be frightened off. Rodario exchanged one of the planks for his sword. Fire was not working for them, so it would have to be steel.
"And all this just because Coira got the wrong end of the stick," he muttered, as he stabbed a horse-headed woman.
Her claw-like fingers failed to grab him, and she careered past into the flames.
"I could be lying by the pond with her, doing all sorts of nice things."
"The pond?" Frenic was running a creature through, half-dog, half-man.
"Not the one by the waterfall?"
"Yes, that one."
"Then you were lucky.
There's a monster at the bottom of that pool. Vought created that one, too.
Frenick was having to step back to avoid a man who had giant crabs, pincers, instead of hands.
Sometimes it comes out and eats everything it can grab.
Rodario groaned.
I might easily have had Koira's death on my conscience.
It sounds like you've been around these parts some time.
I had no choice.
The Famulus leaped through the flames to escape the clutches of a monster, which promptly turned its attentions on the actor. Rodario struck out, but the crab claw caught the blade and snapped it off.
Oh, Samusin and Palandiel, can one of you gods spare a second and come down and help us here?
He hurled the remains of the shattered weapon, injuring the chimera on the head, but he was not able to kill it. The foe sprang forward, pincers agape. Ironheart suddenly appeared and hit out with his crow's beak. The flat side smashed the armor and the claws were broken into tiny pieces. Blood sprayed out of a wound.
Oh, a fish man!
Ironheart rammed the spike through the creature's throat and dragged it to the flames. A quick flick of the wrist and the sharp end of the crow's beak slid out of the creature's flesh and the creature stumbled into the fire.
That smells good. A little bit of mayonnaise on the crab and supper is ready, he laughed out loud.
Rodario saw the Zadar attacking the monsters from the rear. The Chimerae had no idea what was happening to them. They didn't have a chance. Only Ironheart had been too proud to be one of a crowd. He had stormed all the way to the front of the throng to get first choice of the enemy. It had been the saving of Rodario.
Slynn's up there, he called, pointing to the loft. He's not alone.
He'll be all right, said
Ironheart, hurrying to get to one of the last of the hybrids before a Zadar did.
They are huge beasts up there fighting him, bigger than all these, Rodario shouted.
Boindil turned and looked toward the hayloft above the gate.
Then I'll go and check. Fourthlings aren't known for their stamina in battle.
He grinned and made his way over, felling a lynx chimera as he went, which Baskelin had had his eye on.
Ha! I got there first.
Rodario was impressed by the speed and precision with which the invisibles had moved in. The battle in the courtyard was over before he knew it. Surrounded by the dead bodies of that intimidating horde of rampaging monsters, he was struck also by how quiet everything suddenly was. Tungdil had taken no part in the general slaughter. He was talking to Millennia, who was still supporting Koira. Balindar stood guard over Frannic.
My queen!
Rodario hurried over to the young woman. She looked exhausted. Lifting her eyes hesitantly, she instinctively hugged her right arm closer to her body.
I'm all right. The Famulus tried, but he couldn't kill me. Frannic didn't warn us until it was too late. Maybe he forgot on purpose.
He looked at the Famulus, then at Tungdil.
I'd advise you to have a word or two with him. He seemed more eager to talk when you were being persuasive. Maybe his memory has improved a bit.
A loud dwarf laugh rang out from up in the hayloft. Then came the sound of steel on flesh, and then a scream.
What's happening?
Tungdil looked up at the hatch.
I sent Boindil to do some tidying up, Rodario explained. I think Slynn was having trouble, and it seems to be giving your friend a great deal of pleasure to help him out.
They heard Ironheart laughing again, and then angry voices, curses, and the noise of the crow's beak smashing home. Balindar gave a command to the Zadar, but Tungdil interrupted with a gesture.
No! Let him do it on his own. Why shouldn't he have a bit of fun?
He stomped over to Lotionan's former pupil. Rodario asked Millennia to leave him and the Maga alone for a few moments. After a swift exchange of glances with the queen, the Ido girl followed Tungdil. Koira looked up shyly.
Did you?
No, I haven't told anyone what I saw, and I shan't. Rodario took her left hand. Back there at the pond, you misunderstood me.
What was there to misunderstand? She flashed, hurt. You said, how ghastly.
Her anger vanished, and her shoulders drooped.
But you were right. Let me explain what you saw. But first, I want you to know what I was really trying to say. What a ghastly injury, Koira. That's what I was saying.
Is that all?
She sought his eyes.
That's all. You are far too beautiful and kind and sweet-natured for anyone to say anything unpleasant about. I think you know what feelings I have for you.
Rodario smiled at her and took her hand in his. Will you tell me about it now?
A muffled cry rang out, and a chimera came flying through the hayloft hatch.
He landed directly at the feet of two Zadar, with blood spurting from the many injuries to his chest. For a split second, Ironheart was visible in the opening, long enough for a wave and for them to know he was unharmed. Then he raised his weapon and leaped off to the right with a war cry.
He lives only to fight, was Koira's comment.
It's battle frenzy, hot blood. They always used to say that about him, and rightly so, the actor said with a grin.
Crashes and thumps echoed down from the hayloft. He's having the time of his life, egging them on.
The Magus slipped her hand under his arm.
Thank you, she whispered. Thank you for keeping silent and for not despising me on account of my arm.
It seemed to be difficult for her to speak about the disfiguring blemish.
It happened while I was doing magic once. A spell exploded in my hand and damaged it badly. You would not understand the technicalities because you are not a Magus, but take my word for it. Some parts of the magic spell remain lodged in my flesh. That's why I can't heal the wound permanently. It can only be hidden if I've enough magic power in me to suppress it. The less power I'm left with, the more the injury opens up and festers. A long-lasting spell contains the sensitive area inside a kind of glass covering. That's what you saw. No one notices. I always wear gloves.
Rodario felt enormous sympathy for the young woman.
And what happens when your magic runs out completely? My arm will be destroyed.
Koira gave a brave smile.
I shall lose it.
From the state of your arm, I can guess you have very little magic left.
Am I right?
He checked how close the dwarves were standing to see if they would have been able to overhear.
A second chimera came flying through the loft opening, landing next to the first.
Its skull had been smashed, and there was a gash on the right-hand side of its head.
One more to go, they heard Ironheart crowing. One more, then I'm done. Huzzah! They're a whole lot tougher than orcs.
The Zadar laughed. Koira took a deep breath.
It's true. That's why I had set my hopes on the source that was supposed to be in the Red Mountains.
Rodario felt he must have turned pale.
So are you in any way capable of facing Lot Ionan?
Now I've done it!
They all heard Boindil's voice as a third defeated chimera plunged to the ground from the hayloft. The victorious dwarf appeared, supporting Slynn and wearing a grin wider than his own face.
That was just my type of battle, he exulted. Decisive victory, killing marauding beasts, saving a comrade's life. What more could I want?
He nudged Slynn, who moaned in response.
Ho, Fortling, show your teeth and smile for us. You're still alive. These beasts aren't, he said,
indicating the three slaughtered tentacle creatures. He brought the dwarf over to the fire and set him down next to Balindar and Franek.
I could murder a whole barrel of dwarf beer.
He gave a deep sigh. Rodario applauded and put on a cheerful face. Then he turned back to Koira.
Tell me, honestly, can you defeat Lot Ionan or not?
Chapter 23 The Outer Lands, The Black Abyss, Fortress Evildam, Spring, 6492 Solar Cycle. Goda leaped up,
awakened from deepest sleep.
Alarm trumpets?
The door burst open, and Bowen Darlin called her to come out onto the battlements.
The barrier! It's gone! The beasts are trying to get through the north gate!
The Maga sprang out of bed, throwing her robe over her night attire. She slipped her boots on and followed her son. It must still be the middle of the night. It felt at least as though she had only just dropped off. She grabbed her coat and the reticule that had contained the last four splinters of diamond. She had not vouchsafed to a soul the current state of the magic defences, not even to her children. Their recent sortie was deemed a victory despite the heavy losses, and they had celebrated in order to honour the sacrifice of the fallen warriors. The monsters of the Black Abyss were beginning to rebuild their war machinery, it was true, but they were working more slowly this time. They seemed exhausted, and that had been enough to give the defenders a ray of hope. But appearances have been deceptive, Goda thought, and she and Bowen Darlin travelled up in the lift to reach the tower. They've tricked us, and lulled us into being negligent. The battlement walkways and tower over the gateway were starkly illuminated, with all the torches lit. Streams of boiling pitch were being tipped out of the special gullies, and glowing coals hurled down onto the beasts laying siege to the fortress. Arrows and spears shot out from the catapults. Burning sacks of petroleum were dropped over the edge to burst on landing, turning monsters into living torches. Fire arrows whizzed to and fro between the defenders and besiegers, piercing the black clouds. It was an impressive picture. But the monsters were not dismayed by the strength of the bombardment. Small, mobile battering rams were at hand and already being used, as Goda could hear from the repeated thuds. The screams of monsters in the distance sounded only as a monotonous low murmur, like the babbling of a brook. The magic screen had disappeared, and none of the smaller beasts were on the plain anymore. They were all heading for the north gate, taking their half-completed siege towers with them.
I don't get it, Goda said to herself. Why on earth the north gate? Are they trying to draw our attention away from the south gate?
She leaned over and looked down.
We thought it was a trick at first, too, Bowen Darlin said. But the other towers report no activity. The beasts are attacking in the north in a mad frenzy and the gate guards are in trouble. I've given orders for all the soldiers and ammunition to be sent over. I want to see for myself.
Goda watched the Black Abyss closely as she ran with her son past the western gate and on to the northern defences. It was a very long way. The ravine was in darkness and the paths leading out of it were empty and abandoned. Every single one of the monsters had assembled at the northern gateway.
Either their reinforcements are hiding, waiting to see what the outcome will be, or else they haven't got any extra forces, Bowen Darlin told her when he saw her inquiring glance. So the northern gate is not a bad choice for them. It's the last place we would have expected them to attack. But they must know we can move in extra troops fast along the battlements through the inside corridors, she objected. It's a false attack, I'm convinced. They're trying to distract us.
She watched the fighting, which was growing more violent now.
Where is their Magus?
No sign of him, replied Bowen Darlin.
Do you think? They are carrying out the attack for him, said Goda. He's planning something. He wants to tie up all our efforts on that one side.
She looked over at the south tower and stopped.
I'm going to hurry back. You get to the north tower and take command. As soon as you spot the Magus, send me a message.
She embraced him swiftly and departed at speed. Bowen Darlin charged off in the opposite direction. Bandal tied his boots, threw on his chainmail shirt, grabbed his axe, and hurried into the corridor. Even if no one had given them the call to arms, the young Famulus wanted to be part of this. The fortress might be in need of every bit of available help.
Wait!
The door to Sander's chamber was open, and his sister came out. She was also wearing armor and carrying an axe. They were both gifted in magic,
but this did not prevent them using conventional weapons sometimes. Not being the same standard as their mother, they could not rely solely on their magic.
"Didn't they wake you either?"
Bandal adjusted her helmet. She thanked him by correcting the lacing on his chainmail tunic.
"No. Mother wanted to let us sleep."
He looked at her.
"Or do you think it's because of the failure of the mission?"
"It wasn't a failure," she retorted. "We killed lots of the beasts and destroyed masses of their equipment." He sighed.
"You know what I mean."
He ran off, his sister at his heels.
"You reckon they think more highly of our warlike siblings and brother Boendarlin?"
"That may be so." Sandra held her axe in her hand. It got in the way in her belt.
"That's why it's important we are seen."
They hurried along the corridor that housed their family's rooms. This was where the dwarves rested, and where they shared their community life. Evil Dam was nothing but an artificial symmetrical mountain with a system of tunnels and chambers. They crossed the communal living area, where the double blades often met up and sat together in the evenings to discuss the events of the orbit, on past the kitchen, and then they reached the lift shaft that went all the way from the foundations to the highest battlement tower. The lift was a tremendous boon. Bandal touched the lever to move the weights and called the lift cage down to their level.
"I wonder what the monsters are up to."
"It must be pretty bad if they sounded the alarm for the whole fortress," Sander said thoughtfully.
"Apart from where we were,"
Bandal decided that after the attack, or whatever it was, he would have a serious talk with his mother. Even if she did not want any of her Famuli near her, he and his sister needed to be told of any danger. How did it look if the fortress's commander's own children slept on in comfort while the defenders on the walls were fighting for their lives? The lift cabin turned up, and they pushed the grill aside and got in. To their surprise, the lift travelled down, not up, as the young magician had directed the machine.
"Is it broken?"
Bandal moved the handle a few times, and the cage's descent slowed.
"Perhaps there's someone else wanting to use it."
Sander counted the marks on the shaft wall as they passed. They had reached the ground floor. The lift jerked to a halt, but there was no one standing waiting.
"Where are we?"
"By the entrance," Sander looked out.
"Hey, anybody there? Did someone want to come up top with us?"
Then the cabin was jolted. One of the transmission chains had broken, slamming onto the roof of the cage and unreeling noisily. The whole cage structure creaked and bent under the extra weight, and the cabin started to crumple.
"Get out!"
Bandal ordered, giving his sister a push. Before he could follow her, the second chain broke, and the lift shot down into the darkness. Sander stumbled forward into the corridor, heard the infernal crash behind her, and whirled round. She saw the second chain flying past, and heard the bang and clank of the impact. The chains were still unreeling and burying the lift and her brother with it. He was right down at the bottom of the fortress lift shaft.
"Bandal!"
She shrieked in alarm and went over to the shaft, where the ends of the chain were snaking past. One last clank and then quiet. Far below her, she could make out the steel-grey shimmer of the broken cabin and the chain links.
"Bandal!"
The dwarf girl turned and was about to head for the stairs, but someone called her name. The voice came from the shaft. She turned quickly, leaned over, and used her hands as a loud hailer.
"Bandal, hang on!"
A beige shimmer of light coming from above made her lift her head. She froze with terror and could not turn away. 5 paces overhead, the leader of the monsters hovered in midair. Countless fingers of light shot out from his Vrakasium armor to meet the walls of the shaft as he sank gently down. He had his hammers stuck in his belt. His right armored gauntlet was glowing and held a torn length of glowing chain links. The lift's collapse had not been an accident. Still held aloft by the beams, he gradually reached Sander's level and walked toward her. The soles of his boots met stone with a metallic clank.
he crouched down by the dwarf girl. His left hand took hold of Sander's chin, forcing her head round so that she was staring her adversary directly in the disfigured face. She noticed a turquoise